originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Sabre wins the Derby for Todd Fletcher.
Basalt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Jude Feld.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Trainer Talk. Tonight's broadcast, sponsored by Fasig Tipton, is the show that trainers listen to. This is Jude Feld, and I'm absolutely delighted to spend the next hour with you and our special guest. Tonight's trainer grew up in Rosemead, California, just 6 miles from Santa Anita Park. He's won 1,523 races in his career, including a Grade 1 victory with drag race in the Del Mar Futurity. His trainees finish in the money a whopping 50% of the time, and along the way, he's amassed over $22 million in purse earnings. We were stable mates for a long time and have been friends for 35 years. Welcome to Trainer Talk, Steve Miotti. Hey, Steve.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, good.
It's
been a while since we've hung out, but we always had a good time when we did.
Yeah, well, you kind of disappeared on us.
Yeah, I probably did. I went to work for Keeneland. You know, life gets in the way sometimes. I got a divorce, and it was hard to train horses with kids and all of that stuff. So I went into the publicity business, but it's been good for me. But you've been hanging in there training horses the whole time, and that's one of the fun things about preparing for Trainer Talk. Especially when it's a trainer that I know well, it's learning cool things about him that I didn't know. You know, like for instance, I bet on your horses all the time because they win a lot, but I had no idea that you won over 1,500 races. That's a lot of races. That's pretty impressive.
Well, yeah, but apparently it's a well-kept secret because I don't have really that many horses right now.
Well, that's part of the beauty of being on Trainer Talk. Somebody may hear all your accomplishments and go, I want that guy to train for me. It happens all the time. So hopefully this will get the word out for you a little bit. Who hooked you on racing? How did you get involved in the sport?
Basically growing up, you know, just down the street from the track, I went as a kid. You know, and as like a lot of kids that went there, we used to jump the fence.
Right. Been there, done that. Yeah. Did you go by yourself with friends or a relative? Or?
Oh, no. Yeah, we all went with just a bunch of kids, you know. And we'd get someone who could drive, and we'd go up there with our 10 or 12 bucks. That's when we had to jump the fence. We could afford to pay to get in.
That's right. Yeah, did you have somebody that looked old enough to bet?
Yeah, we would always find someone that would bet for you. And then most, you know, the one thing about the racetrack, you know, over the years it's taken a lot of knocks, but it's actually one of the safest places for kids, because everybody there has a single purpose: to make money.
Right.
And it really is. It's nowhere near as nefarious place as it's, you know, as people think it is.
Yeah, I think it's a great place to grow up, to learn, to, you know, I at one time they were thinking about banning kids from Del Mar, and Hank Wesch, the sports writer down there for the San Diego Union, he asked me one day, what do you think about it? I said, I learned so much as a kid. You know, going to the track, I learned how to win, how to lose, how to be gracious, how to tip a waitress, how to you know, handicap, learn about fractions, all of those things. When I was in third grade, the nun asked about fractions. I raised my hand and I answered every question. She said, how do you know so much about fractions? I went up and I drew a racetrack on the chalkboard and put the poles in, you know? She thought I'd lost my mind.
Well, there you go. I think most kids that grow up at the track become accustomed to speaking to adults, too, which helps them later on. They're not intimidated by talking with older people.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. Yeah, it's absolutely true. And, yeah, it's a great place. It's almost like a family, too. You get to...
It is. Everyone looks out for everyone else's kids. You have, like, 80 babysitters on any given afternoon or morning.
Yeah.
Everybody knows your kids. Everybody's looking out for them.
Right. Right, that absolutely true. Well, I read that Sham and Linda's Chief in 1973 was the race that really impressed you. Is that true?
I was going to Santa Anita during what is often regarded as the glory years. You know, Ancient Title, you know, Vigors, Royal Glen, all those type of horses. But yeah, that's when I really got I understood the Derby fever.
Yeah, that's those were two awesome horses back in the day, and you know we were fortunate to be at Santa Anita during those times when all the great trainers were there, all the fantastic horses, you know, Spectacular Bid and Flying Pacer and all those horses, Whittingham, Barrera, Frankel, Eddie Gregson. I mean, all these you know top trainers and. I mean, it was the golden age. I always say it's like we got in at the tail end of the golden age of racing. And I was surprised to find out that you're the same age that I am. Basically, we're both 1957 models, and but I always thought you were way younger than me.
Well, that's the whole thing about being Asian. You know, we look young our whole life, and then one day you wake up and you look like Yoda. You know, that's how it goes.
Oh, you're a classic. That's great. Well, anyway, you're very well preserved, so that's good. Training does that for people, though, huh? Like with the exercise, being outside. I think it's a great lifestyle.
Every day, early, there is a lot of truth to that old adage, you know. And I've always people have always mistook me for my age. And that I think it actually hurt me early when I left Mike Mitchell, is that I looked like I was 14 years old, and here I was training horses. But you know, hopefully it all comes around to be okay.
Yeah, well, I think everything's going your way currently. At what point did you think being a trainer was going to be your life's work?
Oh, I was naive enough to think that. As a freshman in high school, I was going to be a horse trainer. And I ended up going to college to, my mother made us all promise we'd go to college. We didn't know, we were too stupid to know she was actually dying. So when I was like 14, she made us promise we'd all go to college. So, I mean, it was like already then, well, I'll go to college, but I'm going to be a horse trainer. And so then when she did die, I had to delay my racetrack career. I had to go to college.
Yeah. Well, that's very interesting. So you had no idea that your mom was ill and didn't have long to live?
No, we were too wrapped up in our own lives. You know, I played sports, and, you know, she had gotten very ill, and then she came out of the hospital. We didn't know she was coming home to die. We thought she was okay.
Uh-huh.
I mean, she lasted about a year, but we were just young kids.
Wow. Well, there's another thing I didn't know about you. If you joined us late, this is Trainer Talk, and we're talking with Trainer Steve Miotti on the Horse Racing Radio Network. You went to UC Santa Barbara?
Yes, and the whole time I was there, you know, even though I got real good grades, and the corporations were coming in and interviewing, I refused them all because I was going to be a horse trainer. My friends would... Oh, no, not at all. I ended up even interviewing once at Arthur Anderson, and I hated it. I knew right then this is not for me.
Yeah, you know, I can't even picture you in a tie and a jacket.
I had to borrow everything, the tie, the car. But I knew right then that it wasn't for me. I only did it because A lot of my mates said I was making the biggest mistake of my life, but I never regretted it.
Yeah, that's great. Do you find that because you went to college, because you have that business background, that's helped you as a horse trainer?
Not at all. I mean, most owners, they want to know who you like in the sixth race. They could care less what you think about the S&P 500.
Well, that's true. But what about like you know, paying bills and being savvy about, you know, how much money you spend, your payroll and that kind of stuff? Does it help you that way?
No, I don't think so, because it helps me just in a – I can understand when I have a couple bad beats at the racetrack that there's more – it's a bigger world out there than just the small fishbowl we're in. But no, I don't think it really helps a lot. I don't even like to tell, you know, it's a part of the life that I did, but I really don't, you know, speak about it much, nor do I tell. I would tell, unless somebody asked me, it's not something that I think has furthered my career.
I gotcha. That's an interesting take. You worked for two trainers before you went out on your own in 1987, John Russell and Mike Mitchell. There couldn't be two more diverse men in philosophy and style. I mean, do you agree with that?
Oh, yeah. Well, the reason, while I was going to college, I used to work the sales, the two-year-old and training sales. And so I would always be asking these trainers. I was preparing my post-grad, you know, business prospect. I would always ask these trainers, and most of them looked at me, you know, I'm Asian. I look like I was, like I said, I look like I was 14. And the only one who said, yeah, I'll give you a job is Richard Cross, who worked for John Russell. And he said, no problem. You know, when you're ready, when you graduate, come on down. And that's what happened. I got a job straight, you know, out of college working for John Russell. But therein lies where it changed after a couple years rubbing horses with John. There was an old groom there who used to be a harness trainer, and he saw me asking all these questions and always interested and bugging John and Richard Cross about how to train. And one day this groom said to me, hey, so you want to be a trainer, huh? And I said, oh yeah, I'm gonna be a trainer. And he goes, really? He says, are you from a wealthy family? I said, no. He says, do you have any rich friends? I said, no. He said, so how are you going to be a trainer? And I said, you know, I really haven't thought about it. He says, this is what's going to happen. You and your buddies are all going to get together. You're going to claim a horse for $10,000. That's how you're going to be a trainer. And I said, wow, that sounds like a good idea. And he says, well, you're at the wrong barn, buddy. I go, what do you mean by that? He goes, all we have here is allowance, stake, very high claiming, for very strong owners. He said, you want to be a claiming trainer? Go ask the best claiming trainer here on the grounds. And that's what I did. I went to go work for Mike.
Well, that was some fantastic advice, huh?
Yeah, but the funny thing is when I told John I was going to quit, and in John Russell's operation, he had a big-time operation, none of us help were ever allowed in the office.
Really?
Now I told John I was quitting, and he said, in his English accent, he asked me, he said, well, come inside the office and sit down. I'd never been in there. So I sat down, and he said, so who are you going to go work for? And I told him, Mike Mitchell. I said, I want to be a trainer. And he says, you will be a trainer. He says, but it'll be the biggest mistake you ever make. And I said, really? He goes, yes. He said, once you work for a guy like Mike Mitchell, you will be labeled as a claiming trainer. And that was before the days that Bobby Franco and Gary Jones had made the transition from claiming trainers to stake horse trainers. Because in those days, that's really, it was almost a caste system. You know, if you wanted to be have good horses, you went and worked for Charlie or Laz Barrera or you know, Ron McAnally. You didn't go work for the claiming trainers. But so when John told me this, he said, now, you know Owen Hardy. Owen Hardy was working there also. He said, now Owen's going to be a trainer too. He says, but he's not going to train claiming horses. He's going to have good horses. He said, so the decision is up to you. He says, you should stay here. You're going to work here a long time as an assistant. He said, as a groom and then an assistant. He says, and you will have good horses. And like a young, dumb, I said, okay, John, thanks. I said, I'm leaving Friday. And I went to go work for Mike on Saturday.
In typical Steve Miotti fashion, always going a little bit against the grain, right? Well, it's funny you should bring that up with John Russell, because when I won my first 100 grander, first grade race, it was at Santa Anita. You might remember the horse Pewter Gray. And, when I won the race, I beat John Russell and Charlie Whittingham. And they both had quotes in the racing forum. And John Russell said the reason I won was because I was a claiming trainer and I was willing to work my horse on and off track. That was his quote.
Well, I think that's a little unfair, but.
And Charlie said,
"That's how John was."
They said whoever wrote it, I can't remember. It might have been John White. I'm not sure, but whoever it was said, "Wasn't it great that Jude Feld won his first 100 grander? You know, even though you got beaten." He says, "You got to squash the ants before they eat the whole picnic."
Charlie actually had a lot of quotes along that vein.
Yeah. But John had that thing in his mind that you were either one or the other. There was no gray area for him. And he was very proud to have that kind of a barn where he didn't train claiming horses and this and that. It's amazing how hard-headed he was in that philosophy, because there were plenty of guys that could train a good horse. Good horses are pretty easy to train. It's the ones that you claim that you have to do something with, that you have to, reinvent. That's the difficult part.
That's why I didn't realize it at the time, but working for Mike, we saw every kind of horse with every kind of problem.
Right. There's nothing better, I don't think, than working for somebody who has a large claiming operation because of that. It's like going to school. Yes. Every day there's something new, and the more horses you have, like in those days Mike would have 40, 50 horses, and every day there'd be a new horse with a new issue that you had to deal with, and that's invaluable when you go to train.
Oh, yes. We were claiming and losing horses. It seemed like it was daily.
Yeah. And Mike didn't seem to care. Like sometimes, I'll never forget one night, I don't know if you'll remember this or not, but we're back at the barn in the evening. Mike had claimed a horse out of the last race and he didn't have a stall for it. And he just threw it in a stall with another horse. Do you remember that?
Yeah. That always didn't work out well.
Yeah, sometimes not. Yeah. Sometimes they didn't get along, but it was a novel idea.
Yeah, well, and plenty of those nights he would just say, hey, we claimed a couple. We're going to claim a couple today, so you figure it out. And I would have to walk the barn area looking for stalls. Oh, that was, I did that a lot too.
Yeah. Yeah, that was the thing back in those days, because the limit on stalls was, I believe, only 40. Yeah. So
they were very strict about it.
Yeah, once you got past that, it was like borrow from whoever you could. And sometimes you'd have a horse, three quarters of a mile away that you'd have to send a groom to go take care of.
We'd have to change stalls almost every day.
Yeah, it was crazy back in those days. So you move to Mike's barn. You start your education in the care and feeding of horses that are not of the top caliber. How much did you notice the difference between the two?
Oh, well, right away, just the use of ice. We iced almost every horse in Mike's barn, and the training was so much lighter than what I had become accustomed to at John's barn. John's horses went the right way. Mike's horses went the wrong way. And for those familiar, when you gallop, you go one way, and when you jog horses, you just go the other. And that was basically what we did, how we trained a lot of horses. We never got them into a gallop. ever.
Yeah, a lot of jogging, some ponying.
Ponying, jogging, and swimming.
Yeah, very, very light training. Whereas, you know, John Russell, kind of hard on horses every day, you know?
Well, yeah, John had a lot of heavy colts, too, that needed, you know, if you just jogged those colts, they would laugh at you. You know, they needed to be trained a little more.
Right. So, between the two guys, what have you incorporated into your life, your training regimen from those guys?
From John, I basically learned the importance of working after the break only. If you can't go on a good track, then you wait till the next break. Go on a good track.
Right.
That's mainly a lot. And I also took from John, it's better to, you know, your first work back, I always like to go easy. And John always, John used to work 9 to 10 days after they'd run the slowest 5 furlongs imaginable. And I don't think I do that. Well, at least I don't do it on purpose. It happens that way sometimes. But and for Mike, I just learned that you don't train your horse the way you think and don't be influenced by whatever you've heard, whatever you see. Just go with what you know.
Yeah, that's a good philosophy. I was talking to a young trainer the other day, and he was kind of second-guessing himself about, you know, what he was doing with this horse. And I asked him that. I said, well, what do you think you should do with them? You know, and he says, well, you know, I think I should do this, this, and this, but the owner thinks that. I said, you can't listen to the owner tell you how to train the horse. You know, the owner's sitting somewhere, oftentimes in another state, behind a desk in an office building. You're with that horse every day. I said, you got to do what you feel like is the right thing to do with the horse because you're with them every day. You know, it's
I think that therein lies a problem for all trainers, I believe. It's the happy medium between, you know, your owners, what they have in mind, and you know, the reality of what you see in front of you every day.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's, and it seems like, especially in these days, with social media and all that stuff, there's so much information out there, and owners are taking a bigger, have more influence. Yeah. They're picking spots. They're looking at the stakes book. You know, I mean, we used to laugh, you know, back in the day, like if an owner looked at a condition book, it was an extra $10 a day to train for him. You know, people used to say that.
Yeah, in those days, Mike, we used to have a stapler at the barn, and whenever a trainer would come with a book, Mike would say, "Hey, let me look at that for a second." And then he'd put 15 staples in it, and then he'd hand it back to the owner and say, "Here you go."
Yeah, that's classic Mike. It's everything's out there. A horse breezes. I heard a story yesterday about a trainer who breezed his horse, and the owner didn't think it was fast enough, and he called, and the guy had to defend the workout from the horse over the phone like 5 minutes after it happened. And it's,
well, yeah, we have the, you know, the XBTV. I think it's great. I think it's a great tool for people, handicappers, to use and to learn about what these workouts and what is trying to be accomplished and what is being accomplished every day. But I think as far as some owners are watching this, and yeah, they feel their horse, you know, isn't working fast enough, which is fine, but it's always the day after you work that I'm always worried about. How
right.
They pull up.
Yeah. Yeah, how do they come out of it? And,
yeah,
you know, fast works don't necessarily mean good works. They just mean that they're fast works.
Exactly. Michael used to say, it's not how fast they do it, it's how they do it.
Right. Yeah. And by that, you mean you want them to finish, you want them to be within themselves, you know, whatever, yes. However it's designed.
Yes. You don't want a horse to be all in the last 200 yards and it work.
Right.
You don't want to get to the bottom of them in the morning.
When you were working for Mike, you rubbed horses for Nick Alexander, who's one of the most loyal guys in our sport. Talk about that relationship a little bit.
Well, you know, Nick is, you know, he the thing about Nick is he's bred horses for a long time. And he had a ranch up north, and it was really kind of out of his control. It was so far away. I think the key to his success is actually he hired Kerry Matheson, I think that's your last name, from Golden Eagle, and then he was able to get his farm in Santa Ynez and to be a hands-on. He's not just an owner and a breeder in name. This is a guy who he plants the alfalfa, he spreads the manure, he loves being on a tractor. He's there when they fall. He is very hands-on, even though he's a successful businessman in any aspect, in any way you want to measure it. He loves doing this. And so, actually, I've been training him for a long time, but he didn't really have a good horse. He never bred a good horse until he had I think his first stake horse, Mike had, which was Grazing.
And, which he now stands at the farm, right?
Exactly. And I remember the day that he's by Benchmark, and, you know, I don't know if Benchmark is really a sire of sires, but I remember the day that he retired Grazing, and he said he was going to get all these mares and breed them, and Mike called me, and he said, well, you know, you're younger than I, so I think you should have all these Grazings. Because this is the hardest thing in the world to do. Stand your own stallion. And, you know, having been around Mike my whole life, I said, no, Mike, you are the master. I think you should have them all. And we were just joking. And we carried this joke on for a year until we got these Grazings. Okay, and the first couple Grazings, they actually came, you know, up to me at the Golden Gate. And so Mike hadn't seen any of them. And so here we are. We have a first-year sire, and these horses came in pretty big, a lot of leg on them. And they all look like they – even now, I think the one thing about Grazings is you always think they're going to run long. Because they have this big, long, beautiful stride, and there are some that will route, but in general, I think most of them are sprinters. But anyway, so when we get these, I get these horses, and at the time, Mike had he was going into the Del Mar meet, and he was a couple behind McAnally. And Ronnie only had, you know, a dozen horses or so. Mike goes down there with 50. And yet Mike couldn't win. He was putting a lot of pressure on himself. And so he went into a horrible slump trying to chase this record, which he was going to break anyways, but he wanted to get it over with. So he called me and he said, hey, do you have anything you can send down to me and run at Del Mar? This record's killing me. And I said, yeah, I'm going to enter a couple tomorrow. And he says, really? He says, who owns them? And I said, they're homebreds of Nick Alexander. And Mike pauses, and he said, Steve, I'm trying to break the record. And I said, Mike, these horses can really run. And Mike says, well who do you have to ride? I said, I have Garrett Gomez on one and Martin Garcia on the other. They're both for maiden 50, cowbred. And Mike says, oh, man. He says, do you really like them? I said, Mike, these horses are working good. I said, Mike, you should go up to Nick's place. It's a lot different. It's totally, he's got everything under control, and these horses are coming out of there big and strong, well-broke, et cetera, et cetera. And Mike says, oh, all right, well, he says, I got to break this record. If you like these horses, you know, send them down. So I sent them down, send the papers down. They galloped a couple days there, and Mike entered them. And the first one, first time started with Martin Garcia, won by 10. Just won by 10 and got claimed. And so Mike calls me and says, well, man, you were right about that one. What about the one the next day? And I said, Mike, the filly has been outworking the colt who just won by 10. And Mike says, come on. I said, yeah. I said, and if he got claimed, she's going to get claimed. And so anyway, she's the next day she's 3-5 or 4-5 with Garrett. She won easy. She gets claimed. So now Mike ties with the first one, and he breaks the record. And he was gracious enough to give me a lot of credit, not as much as I deserve, but a lot of credit on TVG. But this is how Mike is. So now 2 days later, it's a Tuesday, and he calls me, and he's driving. And I said, hey, boss, what's up? And he says, nah, nothing. I says, where you going? Sounds like you're traveling. He goes, huh, what do you think? I'm going to Nick Alexander's farm. You told me you got some runners. I'm about 20 minutes away. And that was Mike.
You did him a favor, yeah, and you gave him the store.
No, that's Mike. And, yeah, you know, he got me Nick Alexander, and there was never. We traded horses. We swapped them. And always in the best interest of Nick, always.
That's great. Well, this is Jude Feld, and you're listening to Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. And we're going to come back with Steve Miotti after a short break, talk more about this magnificent stallion, Grayson.
The Fasig Tipton Gulfstream Sale. Join us Florida Derby Week at the nation's premier destination for selected two-year-olds in training. From Kentucky Derby winner Nyquist to recent stars like Dreamtree, More Spirit, Audible, and Mopetism, Gulfstream grads are hotter than ever. This year's sale boasts quality from top to bottom and an under-tax show held over Gulfstream's dirt racetrack. Selected sales, superior results. The Fasig Tipton Gulfstream Sale, March 28th. Where will you be?
Bloom Racing.
Majestic City could also still do it, and here he comes.
Majestic City running a big one.
Started by former jockey and 35-year racing industry veteran Jeffrey Bloom, Bloom Racing offers racing partnerships, bloodstock services, pinhooking, and private race management.
Soul Driver the leader, though. Soul Driver in front.
Experience the fun, excitement, and exclusive access of racehorse ownership with Bloom Racing. Forming racing partnerships now. Get in on the action at bloomracing.com.
It all started with a dream. A dream to be the best. To breed the best. To race the best.
Super Saver Ross Lyon, one of the names in the class.
And to stand the best. Windstar Farm. Dedicated to the dream.
A leader in turf racing across North America, Woodbine, one of the world's most dynamic gaming, racing, and entertainment companies, returns for championship thoroughbred horse racing in April. Committed to racing excellence and innovation, Woodbine is proud to offer the Graded Stakes Bonus Program for the 2018 racing season, allowing horsemen and women alike more opportunities to race against the best of the best. Woodbine continually strives to bring the most competitive and high-quality fields to the horse racing community and to its fans, and with this offer, now is your chance to race with champions. Owners, trainers, and horses come for the action and excitement. They come for the finest in hospitality treatment and dining. They come for the competitive purses. They come to Woodbine, the Northern Gem, transcending the sport of racing today for tomorrow. To learn more about the Graded Stakes Competition Bonus, call the Woodbine Race Office today.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
at the top of the stretch. Richard's Boy, Tough Sunday, chased into the stretch, three lengths away by B Squared. Masochistic dropping away. Smoky Image on the outside gets to fourth. Tough Sunday has headed Richard's Boy. Tough Sunday kicks clear with a 16th left to go. Smoky Image and Solid Wager finishing well. It's Tough Sunday in front. He's tough any and every day of his life. Tough Sunday from Solid Wager, Smoky Image, Tribal Storm, and Brando the Bartender.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Phasing Tipton. This is Jude Feld with our special guest, Trainer Steve Miotti. And I want to remind you that if you missed any portion of this show, it will be archived on our website, horseracingradio.net, and is also available at Horse Racing Radio on iTunes. Sunday rules, a tremendous story. What did you think when Nick told you about this grazing?
Well, I still remember when he asked me if I wanted to train him, and he told me the problems that he had. But, you know, since we had such a long-term relationship, I said, no problem, you know, send him in. And when he came in, there's never been a question of his sight. Of course, he doesn't talk, but he can, you know, he sees everything. His hearing is one of the that has always been a question mark. And when he was young, he just never broke. He just couldn't hear the bell. And so there's been a lot of schooling, a lot of standing. We stand him all the time so he can get every advantage of being calm in the gate. But he's always been a very big horse. And I'd say the thing about training him, of course, he's 6 years old. It took me quite a long time to learn this about him. But he's the type of horse that if you under-train him, he really shows up. He's had some sparkling A-works, 58s, and fancy works like that. He never runs to those works. I think he's at three of them, and he's at three races where he's just in fire. So over by trial and error, I've learned to, we actually under-train him in these races. And with that, you're always a little nervous. I think most of us trainers, we probably over-train him. So it's a little bit different with him, but that's because he's such a big horse.
Yeah,
we go light with him, and he always seems to show up.
That goes back to what we were saying. I mean, if you know your horse, you know what to do with them, and it might not be, you know, by the book, if there is such a book. But what a fantastic job. I mean, you take this horse that was born a dummy foal, blind and deaf. He gets his sight back a little bit, and you know, develops into a good looking horse. You've run him 18 times, 5 wins, 5 seconds, 5 thirds. That's phenomenal. And then he goes and wins the Sensational Star the other day. There wasn't a dry eye in the place. And I loved your quote that Mike told you there was no rooting around him.
Yeah, when you watch the race with Mike, you could snap your fingers a little bit and you could lean, but no rooting.
Yeah, you said you cheered the whole length of the stretch. You were sure Mike,
oh, yeah.
Mike was looking down, really, really upset with you.
Well, you know, because it meant so much to Nick. It really had. And there's so much social media, and this horse has so many followers and well-wishers that Nick actually feels a little bit like a trainer. There's so much pressure on him that I don't know. It was just one of those wonderful things, that stories, and it, you know, it all worked out.
Yeah, it really is a great story. I mean, things like this just don't happen on a very regular basis where a horse just, you know, makes a miraculous turnaround. And I thought it was kind of interesting how, you know, the horse was close to being put down. Sometimes those foals, they can't see. They start bumping into walls. You know, it's a dangerous situation for them.
It was a disaster. He got pneumonia. I mean, right after the difficult birth, and then he has pneumonia. I mean, it was the bill that Adelmo Pintado was astronomical.
Yeah.
And here, Nick Alexander, you know, they say the horse can't see. The horse has pneumonia. Nick couldn't sleep. The next morning he goes in, and he swears that the horse followed his movements. Now, knowing Nick, I think a lot of that was wishful thinking, but that was enough for Nick. He said, do everything you can, whatever it costs. And it cost. It cost quite a bit because it was, I believe, 21 days till he was able to go back to Nick's farm. And then when he gets back there, his mother rejects him. Mm. I mean, it was just a debacle.
Yeah. Well, it's a fantastic story, and you can see why so many people are interested in the horse and love the horse, and I know you do too. It's fantastic to have an opportunity to do something like that, and you came through with flying colors. In case you tuned in late, this is Jude Feld. I'm visiting with trainer Steve Miotti on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Let's talk about some of the other nice horses you've developed. He's not the only one. You've had some pretty good horses. You won the Del Mar Futurity with a horse you bought for $22,000. Talk about Drag Race a little bit.
Well, that was my very first purchase at a sale, and it was an owner from Japan. I bought the horse, and a little did I know that a lot of these horses that you buy for a guy in Japan, he that night turned around and he somewhat syndicated the horse. He took on some partners. This is where the story kind of went the wrong way at first. The next day, I gelded the horse. He needed to be gelded. And so about a week later, when I told him I gelded the horse, he went into a panic because the horse was by Darby Creek Road. He had a little bit of breeding, but like now, everybody wants to get a sire. You know, it's a dream.
Right.
And so he had to give some of the money back and unsyndicate him. But it all worked out. I mean, about six months to the day that I bought him, he won the Del Mar Futurity. And, the very next year I had another nice horse named Music Prospector who actually, he actually went to the Music Prospector, ran fourth in the Preakness. But that's my second year of training. And I think, this is how it's going to be from here on in, just stake races. And little did I know, there was a lot of claiming races in between that day and Tough Sunday last weekend.
Yeah, there is sometimes. And it's funny how your mind plays tricks on you like that. You think, wow, you know, this is really good. I just need to keep this up. But sometimes the horses don't come your way. It's amazing how much luck is involved in our sport.
Oh, yes. Even like my buddy Jerry Hollendorfer, when he got Songbird, actually there was a mix-up. He wasn't supposed to get Songbird. They put the wrong horse on the airplane. But since, they flew out Songbird all the way out here, he was supposed to get a colt. That the owner says, we'll just you take her, and I forget who his other trainer was. He'll take the colt, and the other trainer seemed very happy with the colt, and there you go. I mean, on a mistake, Jerry gets one of the greatest fillies we've seen in the last 20 years.
Yeah, yeah, it's amazing how little things like that work. That happened to me once when I was training for Bruce McNall. I got one of Frankel's, and Frankel got mine, and they were really high on the one that was supposed to go to Frankel, and I keep telling him this filly's training great. She was by Jacqueline Klugman, supposedly. They're going, really? Because they didn't really like her that much at the farm. And Frankel's telling him that this other filly, she's not as great as you guys think. But instead of me getting to keep the good one, I had to send it over to Bobby's barn, and I got the bad one. So that's just the way it goes sometimes. But I wasn't that lucky. What about Mr. Hanks? He's a pretty good horse.
He's a very nice horse. He's still at my barn. We did the operation. He had a condylar fracture, and Dr. Kurt Hoffman did the surgery. The surgery went great. But instead of turning him out, I just kept him. He's still at my barn, still in the same stall. We took the other two screws out last week. I'm going to re-x-ray him on Kentucky Derby Day, and if it looks good, we resume training again. But he's a very, very big, kind, very kind horse. You can put any child you want in the stall and on his back, and he would just stand there like a pony.
That's great. I love those. Kind of love when you go to saddle one of those. It's not jumping all over the place.
Oh, yeah. He's the easiest horse to be around, and he's a very nice horse, and if he makes it back, he has a chance to be a top-class sprinter.
Cool. That's great. Something to look forward to. What about, you know, trainers always have these horses that they know that they did something really great with a horse, and it's usually a horse that nobody knows about, some claiming horse that you did a great job with. Do you have one of those? You probably have more than one. I mean, you've had such a tremendous career. Talk about those kind of horses that you know you did something with this horse that the average person couldn't do.
Well, you know, on a lot of these horses, not just on claiming horses, but mostly on claiming horses, sometimes as they get good, you have to change the way you train them to keep them going. And I think that is one of the hardest things I've had to deal with. And probably, you know, you claim a horse, and let's say you can gallop him. And by the third or fourth or fifth start, he's losing weight. He's still winning. He might have a couple small problems crop up. And so you've changed the way you've trained him, even though you've had him 3 to 10 races, and the form looks the same, but the way you approach him and train him is completely different. So in other words, the ability to adjust as a horse changes, that is one of the most difficult things I think is about training, because it's such a complex deal, it can be, that as trainers, we like to simplify things. It makes life a lot easier. You're able to sleep. But those type of horses that you have to change training as their careers go on, that's the hard thing.
Yeah, that was something that Bobby Frankel was really good at, making adjustments as the horse changed. And we used to talk about that a lot, you know, because I would notice things that he would do with horses, and he'd train a horse a certain way for a while, and then he would switch up and you know, maybe shorten up the works or do more ponying and that kind of thing. And I would ask him about that. You know, he goes, the horse is different now. I have to train him a different way. And I think sometimes you get in a habit of training a horse a certain way because it's been good for you.
The same way.
Yeah.
The same way. But see, so when I went to go work for Mike at Santa Anita, Mike's two best friends in life were Gary Jones and Bobby Frankel. Now, when we're at Santa Anita, Gary Jones is our neighbor, and I was in and out of Gary Jones's barn. Rafael Becerra, who worked for Gary, came to our barn. We were like, you know, very close. Now, when we go to Hollywood Park, Bobby was our neighbor, and so it was funny that here I grew up admiring these guys, and you know, 6, 7, 8 years later, I'm talking to them because I worked for Mike. They would talk to me, and they would answer a lot of my questions. And so, although Mike told me, now, listen, we're going to be neighbors with Bobby Frankel. He said, and whatever you do, do not kiss his ass. I go, what do you mean? He goes, do not Bobby this, Bobby that. You treat him like he's a hot walker, and he'll respect you. I said, Mike, what do you want me to do, yell at Bobby? He goes, yeah, yell at him. Do whatever, but don't go kiss his ass. So anyways, so now my first meet, I'm over at Hollywood Park, we're in the barn, and Bobby was an early guy, but Bobby never bought the form. He used to come in and read my form every morning, and he'd always bring it back, of course. And so after 2 weeks there, Mike says, so, hey, how are you getting along with Bobby? And I go, fine, you know, he comes in and reads my form. And Mike says, what do you mean he reads your form? I said, well, he reads my form. Mike says, I told you, don't kiss his ass. Tomorrow when he comes in to read, you just grab it out of his hands and tell him to get the heck out of here. I said, Mike, he says, just do it. So So the next morning, here comes Bobby marching in. Hey, I'm going to buy your phone. And I yelled at him. I said, you go buy your own. You leave. Here I am yelling at Bobby Frankel. And Mike was right. From that day on, Bobby and I spoke to each other like peers. He accepted me as a trainer. And there you go.
Yeah. Yeah, that was some good advice Mike gave you, because he didn't like the fact that a lot of people would just, you know, kowtow to him. He liked it if you argued with him, if you had a discussion, whether it was about horses or sports or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
whenever Bobby would see Mike doing something that he didn't agree with, you know, there still were two leading trainers, so Bobby would always tell me, but he would yell at me. And it took a while to figure this out. Why is this guy yelling at me? I don't train these horses. He wanted me to tell Mike. And so it was a funny deal that we went through a couple slumps, and Bobby was a watcher of everybody and everything. He knew who was hot, who was not, what combinations working, what he knew everything. And so he would see some things that we did different, and he would come and yell at me. And then it finally dawned on me I was supposed to relay this to Mike. And that's how it went for about 3 years. And I'd say some of the times Mike would say, who's telling you this? Who's giving you these ideas? I go, Mike, I've been here, I'm learning. And Mike would go, no. He says, it's Frankel, isn't it? It's Bobby. Not Mike. Mm. No. Anyways, it was quite an education, you know. So Gary Jones, Bobby Frankel, and I'm working for Mike Mitchell. I mean, I had the equivalent of a Ivy League education when it comes to racetrack.
Yeah, there's no question. I mean, those guys were, you know, all fabulous trainers and you know, really in tune with what was going on. And you're right about Bobby being an observer. I mean, he would, you know, look at everything. And I remember one day when I was working for Julio Canani and I had a filly there that I was training myself that my brother Bob and I had bought together. And so we were going out to the track and Bobby calls me over. He didn't want to embarrass me in front of anybody. He goes, did you look at your filly's legs this morning? I said, yeah. He says, does she have a tendon? I said, no, she's got this vein that goes across the tendon. It's kind of a weird looking thing. I said, do you want to feel it? He goes, no. He says, as long as you looked at it and you're happy with it, I'm happy with it. I said, okay. But you know, like that's how he was. I mean, he didn't have to look at my filly, you know, she was just your average little cowbred filly. But he was paying attention and he, you know, yes. He wanted me to do good. And he was like that with a lot of people.
Yes. Yes. He would, he wouldn't tell you, but he might suggest something that usually, I'd say 99% of the time it was the right suggestion.
Yeah, yeah. Because I used to ask him about horses too sometimes. If I couldn't figure a horse out or whatever, I'd take him over to his barn, and he'd watch him jog or look at their feet or do whatever he was going to do with them, whatever he thought was wrong. And then at the end, he'd always say, you should have Dr. Arthur look at this horse. And it used to crack me up. Dr. Arthur was like his safety valve, right? So anyway, he was an interesting guy and helped me a lot in the business. So do you find that, like, in today's day and age, there's not as much of that camaraderie with trainers? It's more of a cutthroat kind of business now?
Yes and no. I think a lot of it has to do with the type of owners we have now. So many of these groups, when they spread their horses around, so it's a funny deal that you're on the same teams, you know, supposedly, but if you don't do well, the other guy's going to get your horses. I see a lot of that, and there's nothing wrong with it, because I think those groups bring a lot of new people into the game. But yeah, it seems to be run more of a of a business. I don't think trainers are like it was, but then that's just the way life is. It's never going back ever to anything, you know, all aspects of life.
Right. It's a whole different time. So we're at the age now where we could, you know, have a bucket list. What's on the Steve Miotti bucket list?
Well, actually, when I first, when I was working for Mike, Mike had allowed me to have some horses. And so I actually, my dream was to win 100 races as a trainer. That was it. I figured if I won 100 races, I would, that would be a career. And so we did that quite a few years ago, but I'm not a bucket list type of guy. I'm not there yet.
Well, that's good. No, I didn't mean to imply that you were old, but I mean, sometimes, like, you know, trainers, they've always had a goal of winning a particular race or, you know, some feat that they think would be, you know, tough to accomplish. I always wanted to win the San Juan Capistrano. The closest I ever came was fourth, but, you know, you can only win if you got the right horse, but it's interesting how you know, you wanted to win 100 races. You won 1,500 races. If I had told you when you were, you know, that 14-year-old boy going to Santa Anita from Rosemead that you were going to be a trainer that won 1,500 races, what would you have said to me?
I'd have said, don't be doing any of that LSD. It's no good for your health. But actually, if I have a goal, it's right now to win 2,000 races, because my confidant every morning at the racetrack is the great Mel Studi. And Mel won 2,000 races and quit, so I'd like to get to 2,000, because he's a great man, he's a great trainer, and he's a greater human being. And he's my pal.
That's great. Yeah, he's a fantastic guy, and always a pleasure to hang out with Mel Studi.
Yeah, in fact, Henry Marino and Mel hang out together, and I sit at the table, and I said, hey, Mel, I got a horse that I'm a little bit unsure of his fitness. I was thinking about blowing him out. And Mel Studi leans over, and he tells me, this is 6 months ago, he says, Steve, you can't ever blow out a horse fast enough. Go as fast as the horse can. I said, oh, okay. Thanks, Mel. Now, Mel gets up and goes get a coffee, and Henry Marino leans over and says, don't ever do that. So there you go. These are two great trainers.
That's right.
And I'm getting this, you know, here late in my career. But that's the great thing about training.
That's right. Well, there's many, many ways to do it. Buster Milrick,
exactly.
He was more like Mel. So that's funny. Henry chimed in there. When you're... we're almost out of time here, but I'm going to ask you, when you're not at the barn or at the track, what are some of your hobbies? What do you like to do?
I actually play tennis as much as I can, and that's probably it. And I, you know, like everybody, like all other trainers, we probably think too much about training and our horses and the mistakes and the things that we can do to correct that. But that's mainly, I read a lot. I play tennis as much as I can, but I haven't had a day off in quite a while. I know that. But nor do I want one.
Yeah.
I couldn't think of another place that I'd rather be than at my barn.
Well, that's great. That's most trainers, and you've done it as good as anybody can do it. So I just really enjoyed spending this hour with you, and it flew by, and I really want to thank you for taking time out of your very busy schedule to spend the time with
no
us.
No problem. Thanks for calling me, June. It was good to talk to you.
All right. That's Steve Miotti, everybody. Well, this hour just flew by, and a special thank you to Lee Delapina, our super producer, for keeping us in line and on time. And I want to remind everyone to tune into the Equine Forum, the show that launched the network this and every Saturday morning at 8 a.m. on Sirius 219, XM 206, and streaming live on our website, horseracingradio.net. This is Jude Feld from our Jimmy Johns of Lexington, Kentucky studios. Good night, everybody.